KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
It's a scene of joy. I can see every single person here. Do hold a big smile on his face.
Tens of thousands of Palestinians were on the move today, walking north, going home for the first time since the war in Gaza began.
It's Monday, January 27th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. This hour, some kids in Los Angeles have yet to return to school nearly 3 weeks after the wildfires began.
It kind of gives me flashbacks to COVID, and I'm kind of about to go insane.
Also, Susie Wiles is doing something no woman has done before.
She's the first in history to serve as White House Chief of Staff.
Everybody knows that when she speaks, she really, so far at least, is speaking for Donald Trump. That's never been true with her predecessors.
And Saquon Barkley's having a moment.
The star running back is a big reason the Philadelphia Eagles are now in the Super Bowl.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Mexico says it has received more than 4,000 migrants from the U.S. since President Donald Trump took office last Monday. As Nina Kravinsky of member station WKJZ reports, Mexico's president says the majority are from Mexico, but some are from other countries.
It wasn't immediately clear if those 4,000 people are all deportees or if some are migrants who were turned away at the border. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum had said last year that she hoped to reach an agreement with then-President-elect Trump to only take Mexican citizens. Sheinbaum pointed out that Mexico has, in the past, accepted non-Mexican migrants. That can happen in cases where strained diplomatic relations between the third country and the U.S. make it hard to repatriate those people directly back to their country of origin. For NPR News, I'm Nina Kravinsky in Hermosillo, Mexico.
Tennessee lawmakers convened today for a special session on immigration disaster relief and school vouchers. But Mariana Bacallao of member station WPLN reports protesters on the steps of the state capitol were demanding gun reform after Nashville's second school shooting in as many years.
Hundreds of protesters gathered outside the state capitol decrying the legislature's lack of action after a shooting at Antioch High School in Nashville last week.
Doing anything about the guns?
No!
No, because they'd rather attack our immigrant and refugee neighbors.
Tennessee's governor has called the special session to focus, in part, on helping with President Trump's mass deportation efforts. Less than 2 years ago, a deadly shooting at a private Christian school in Nashville inspired its own special session on gun safety. The Republican supermajority didn't pass gun reform then, and protesters say they don't expect them to this time either. For NPR News, I'm Mariana Bacallao in Nashville.
A new AI assistant from a Chinese startup is suddenly more popular than ChatGPT, and that's worrying tech investors. NPR's Maria Aspen reports the tech-heavy NASDAQ closed down more than 600 points today.
The Chinese startup DeepSeek was little known before last week when it released its free AI assistant. Now its app is the most popular download on the U.S. Apple Store. AI experts say that DeepSeek performs almost as well as ChatGPT and other established AI models, and the company says it's much cheaper technology. That's worrying investors who are concerned about how much the tech industry has been spending on artificial intelligence. Meta, Microsoft, Google, and other big tech companies have been pouring billions into AI and promising their investors that it will pay off eventually. DeepSeek is making them wonder whether all this spending was necessary in the first place. Maria Aspen, NPR News, New York.
The S&P 500 fell 88 points. This is NPR. Thousands of Afghans who worked for or fought alongside Americans and hoped to come to the U.S. are now in limbo. That's after President Donald Trump ordered the suspension of the country's refugee program. As NPR's Dia Hadid reports from Mumbai, the suspension is being condemned by former service members who've been advocating for the resettlement of Afghans.
Resettlement advocates say Afghans who allied with the United States before the Taliban seized power in Afghanistan in August 2021 faced the risk of death for their actions. There's about 50,000 Afghans waiting to have their asylum applications processed. Many of them have been waiting in neighbouring Pakistan, but they aren't welcome there. The Pakistani government has been deporting hundreds of thousands of Afghans, arguing it cannot shoulder the burden of hosting so many people. Five Afghans who are expecting to fly to the United States with their families told NPR they feel abandoned and betrayed. Tia Hadid, NPR News, Mumbai.
U.S. public health officials say they're being told to stop working with the World Health Organization immediately. It follows the Trump administration's earlier announcement it plans to pull out of the group, a process that will require an act of Congress. Member to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, viewed by the Associated Press, tells senior leaders to stop any collaborations with the WHO and await further guidance. Experts say it could set back work on investigating and trying to stop outbreaks of Mpox in Africa and other communicable diseases. Crude oil futures prices took a drop today. Oil down $1.49 a barrel to settle at $73.17 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Thousands of Palestinians returned to northern Gaza today. Many fled in the early days of the war and haven't been back in more than 15 months. The Israeli military let people return as part of a ceasefire deal with Hamas. One of those returning home was NPR's producer in Gaza, Anas Baba. He walked back to his city today and sent us voice memos along the way. Here's NPR's Kat Lonsdorf with more.
Anas starts his day early.
It's almost 5:30 a.m. Drones, Israeli drones in the sky.
He's sporting a freshly trimmed beard. He got a barber friend to clean him up before the journey.
Because I'm feeling like today is my wedding, and I'm finally returning back, and I wanted to look as best as possible.
As the sun is rising, he starts the walk with thousands of others.
It's a scene of joy. Everyone is just like saying hi to everyone. They are walking with an energy. Even you can see the elderly are walking like they are young.
Everywhere around him are scenes of celebration.
People are chanting. Some of them, they use drums and instruments as celebration.
The walk takes hours, but that energy persists.
Now I'm getting closer to the outskirts of Gaza City. I'm feeling that there is like shiver all over my body, electricity that's just like gives me more energy to keep going, to keep walking. I'm sorry that my voice is truly like thrilled, but I'm extremely happy. I'm grateful.
As he goes, people who have been in the north throughout the war start to meet people coming from the south.
It's truly unbelievable.
Including this moment.
A mother that she met finally, her own son that she was leaving him in Gaza City. She's in tears.
He stops to interview the mom, Wafa Ibrahim
Al-Arir.
Wow, she says, I left a boy behind, and now I find him a young man. Anas keeps walking. The main road he's walking is along the sea, and he takes a deep breath.
I truly miss the Mediterranean sea air, especially the Gaza Mediterranean. Most of the people here keep saying the same thing. Now we can breathe again.
And then...
finally, I entered Gaza City.
But it's a sobering reality, even amongst the celebration.
Nothing still the same. I can't find any landmark. I don't know exactly what to do here, what to say. There is not much to express.
There is not much to describe here. Rubbles everywhere, destruction everywhere, but you can feel the positive energy. They are trying to hold up. They are trying to carry on. It's not the same anymore.
That's NPR's Anas Baba returning home to North Gaza and NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Tel Aviv.
Students in Los Angeles are still reeling from historic fires. Several schools are damaged or even burned to the ground, and many families lost their homes too. It has been disruptive for young Angelenos who were still trying to recover from the pandemic. NPR's Janaki Mehta spoke to some who are still out of school nearly 3 weeks after the fires began.
Second grader Augusta Robbins is counting down the days till she's back in school.
I really miss my friends, my teachers, and playing soccer.
But that soccer field is covered in ash. Nearly the entire campus of Odyssey Charter South in Altadena has burned to the ground. Augusta's family lost their home, too. They're hopping between temporary housing right now. Augusta says thinking too much about all that makes her anxious.
I feel sad about my school and my house and all my friends. Then I kind of just go off and draw because it makes me feel better when I do that.
She pulls up a drawing she just finished.
What is that?
I've been drawing houses lately a lot. I always draw a new house every day.
Her mom, Jennifer O'Kane, says that for both her kids, Odyssey was the center of their world. They'd lived in Altadena for many years, but they just bought their home about a year ago.
It's a really special school, and a part of our moving to that house was we were like 3 minutes from the school.
Jen's vice president of the school's parent association, and she says like so many other schools, Odyssey took a hit during COVID and was just bouncing back.
With just some other incredible parents, I spent about the last 3 years bringing art and enrichment and field trips and all of that to the schools because they did not have it.
Now, with no school to go back to, she worries about the future of her kids' education.
This massive disaster and trauma and on all of our kids and the future and how that unfolds is just a giant.
Yeah, it's crazy. Everybody's distracted, and everybody's, like, worried.
12-year-old Indy Rothman has already had her schooling disrupted multiple times.
It kind of gives me flashbacks to COVID, and I'm kind of about to go insane.
Indy's family is also displaced while their house is being assessed for damage. It could be months before they can go back. Her school, Octavia E. Butler Magnet, did survive the fires. It was being cleaned up when we met recently. As Indy stood outside the building, she got emotional, thinking about its empty halls.
I just feel like if I go in there, I'd like cry and I'd feel weird because it's usually super loud and crazy and it's not. It's gonna be quiet.
This century-old school, which sits on a hill at the highest point in Pasadena, is a boon to many in this community. It was recently renamed after the pioneering Black author Octavia E. Butler, who's a student here.
We came here because we are a multi-ethnic, multi-religion family, and I really wanted my kids to experience a racially diverse, working-class, family-based town.
That's Indy's mom, Sandy Rothman.
I mean, this was a district that was gutted by redline tactics and integration issues that led to white flight, and they've been through multiple phases of coming back.
We are a high-need school.
That's the school's librarian, Natalie Daly. She worries the fires have added yet another hurdle.
What is this going to do to fragment the population of our school? What is it going to do to our enrollment, which seems like almost a callous thing to even think about, right? But does that mean that it's going to compound the issues that we already have? It's scary.
These are some of the questions families and educators are asking as they figure out when kids will be back in school and what will happen to the ones who don't have a school to go back to. Jen Robbins says losing their home was unimaginable, but she tears up thinking about the moment she realized some schools were gone.
Like if you let a school go, that is the heart of community, right? Like where we send our kids, what we build around. It's hard to know how to rebuild when some of the most just vital parts are gone.
The principal of Odyssey South, Bonnie Brimacombe, told NPR her team is working around the clock to find a temporary location. And Pasadena School District has started reopening some schools that survived the fires, but it isn't clear how long it'll be until things feel normal again.
And until that happens, students like Augusta Robbins and Indy Rothman are finding some comfort in hanging out with friends again.
Hoping I can have a sleepover tonight.
I'm going to get pizza and I'm going to see my friends for the first time and I'm so excited.
Since I last met Indy, it's been announced that Octavia and several others in the district will reopen this week. In Los Angeles, I'm Janaki Mehta, NPR News.
The European Union has renewed economic sanctions on Russia over its war in Ukraine. The EU had to overcome opposition from Hungary, whose Prime Minister Viktor Orban has warm relations with both U.S. President Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. From Brussels, Terry Schultz reports.
The renewal of sanctions by EU foreign ministers keeps in place 15 sets of measures targeting Russia's economy in key sectors including oil, coal, banking and transport, and also keeps frozen more than 200 billion euros of Russian central bank assets. The interest from those immobilized accounts is now being given to Ukraine. EU foreign policy chief Kaya Kallas.
This will continue to deprive Putin of revenues to fund his war.
It nearly didn't happen. With the January 31st renewal deadline looming, Hungary's Viktor Orban exasperated his European counterparts by insisting he'd wait to see what newly inaugurated Donald Trump said about Ukraine and Russia before deciding whether to agree to the extension. Orban has regularly delayed aid and weapons packages for Kyiv and resisted punishing the Kremlin. Trump's surprise suggestion that Moscow could face more punitive measures from Washington if it doesn't end the war may have swayed Orban more than European pressure did, according to Polish Foreign Minister Radek Sikorski.
Donald Trump also has to be credited here because in his statement on Truth Social, he identified Vladimir Putin as the aggressor and threatened him with sanctions. So I hope the Hungarian leadership has seen the wisdom of sanctions.
The Hungarian leadership also got a couple of sentences on EU solidarity over energy security inserted in a statement about the sanctions rollover. This was demanded by Orban after Ukraine cut off Russian gas flows to Hungary. But Michael Bosarku, a senior fellow with the Atlantic Council think tank, who's based in Ukraine, says while Trump may have helped push Orban to restrain Russia this time, the new U.S. administration's holdup of foreign aid is hurting Kyiv.
It's already having an immediate impact on aid to Ukraine, on travel there, on capacity building, that sort of thing. The EU also has to very urgently find ways to step up its assistance to Ukraine.
And in 6 months, when these sanctions face renewal again, the EU will be right back in the same place, having to hope and possibly haggle for Viktor Orban's approval. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. It's been a little more than a month since the Syrian regime fell to opposition fighters. Syrians were euphoric after suddenly being freed from decades of repression. NPR's Jana Raff in Damascus takes a look at how things have changed since then.
One of the ways to gauge life in this new Syria is at this traffic island. It's midday and jam-packed. New cars imported after the fall of the regime, jockeying for space with vehicles that would normally be in a museum. In the midst of this, a man with a Boy Scout scarf and a whistle tries to bring order to the chaos.
My name is Amjad Muhtasib. I am a voluntary with the Boy Scout of Syria. We are trying to help as much as we can here in Syria.
Mahtasid has a shop nearby selling machine engines. Most police disappeared when the regime was toppled, so he volunteered to help. He waves through an emergency vehicle. The oncoming traffic actually stops for him.
As you can see, where we are standing now is a very difficult area, so it's getting better and better now.
Mahtasid, 43, says Syrians were trapped before, between regime repression and international sanctions that isolated Syria's people as well as its leaders.
I used to say to my friends, I don't belong to the earth anymore. I feel like I'm an alien.
Now in these gritty streets, he says his depression has lifted. He feels like he's walking on air.
How are you?
Good, thank you.
Luay al-Shimri, who's 27, is delighted to meet a foreigner. He's from a region near the Iraqi border, and he's come to check out the capital. Under the old regime, it was dangerous to talk to strangers. You never knew who they were. Prisons were full of Syrians arrested off the street for no reason.
Oh, good.
Before, if I talked to this person or that person, they'd say, we're terrorists. They wouldn't investigate. They would just arrest people and take them to prison. He says Syrians want to build a new country, a new life. He says the biggest problem now is the high prices. There are no jobs and no aid organizations helping people. Government workers haven't been paid in 2 months, and agencies and other countries promise to help. But they're trying to rewind a decade of trade sanctions imposed on the Assad regime. Syria is rich in resources, its people industrious. Across the street, painters on scaffolding work on a new luxury hotel. Upscale restaurants are full to those who can afford it. But more than a decade of war and sanctions have left so many Syrians destitute. On the outskirts of Damascus, the Harista neighborhood is mostly damaged buildings and collapsed homes from fighting during Syria's civil war. But on the corner where we're standing, a tiny shop has become a busy neighborhood hub. There are new kinds of imported candy behind a glass shelf, and boxes of fresh fruit and vegetables. Abu Allah Asada, a shop worker, says before no one could afford to buy fruit here because the regime controlled imports and prices. An apple would not enter our homes, he says. We didn't know the taste of bananas. Prices have dropped dramatically now, but people here are still desperately poor. A little girl holds up a small yellow apple and asks the price. Asada weighs it on his digital scale. 2,000 pounds, he tells her, about 20 cents. She puts it back. She doesn't have the money. Back in central Damascus, there are still daily celebrations. People worry about the economy, but also about what happens after dark, when there's a shortage of police and militia fighters roam the streets. Freedom, though, that they still have in abundance, and they are still reveling in it. Jane Araf, NPR News, Damascus.
For fans of an underdog story, next month's Super Bowl might not be the matchup they were hoping for. The Kansas City Chiefs and the Philadelphia Eagles are both perennial winners, but some are finding solace in rooting for one Philadelphia player who's having the season of a lifetime after a change of scenery. NPR's Becky Sullivan reports.
On Sunday, all it took was one touch of the football for Saquon Barkley to leave his mark on the NFC Championship game. Down 3-0 to the Washington Commanders, the Eagles' offense came out for their first play of the game, a toss to their new star running back. Barkley broke a couple tackles, then took it 60 yards to the house, and the Eagles never trailed again. Barkley has been a revelation this season for Philadelphia. He's having the best year of his career by far, more than 2,000 rushing yards in the regular season. And in the playoffs, he already has 5 touchdowns, 3 of them on breakaway runs of 60 yards or longer. That's history book stuff. His teammates, like offensive lineman Lane Johnson, see it up close every week, and even they're blown away.
He's fun. It's like when I used to play Madden, I just tossed to Barry Sanders, and a lot of good stuff would happen. So. No, man, he's a hell of a player, and he's got a big heart. And so, yeah, man, we play hard for him, and he's a great teammate.
The success has been a long time coming for Barkley, who's now in his 7th year in the NFL. He was born in New York City, then picked 2nd overall in the NFL draft by a hometown team, the New York Giants. And there he was stellar from the get-go, loved by teammates and fans alike.
And Barkley takes it all the way, 68 yards. For his first NFL touchdown.
But in his 6 years in New York, the Giants never fielded a truly competitive team. They lost almost twice as many games as they won. And even though Barkley was the team's biggest star, there wasn't much to savor. And even he acknowledged that last week.
You might have media deals, you might have commercials, you might have followers on IG, but at the end of the day, the only thing that matters is how you compete as a team. And if you don't have a great team, it don't matter, you won't be successful. And I think I'm a prime example of that right now.
Barkley's contract with the Giants was up after last season. Usually for NFL teams, it's bad business to let your best player walk. But the Giants did. And not only that, they did it on TV. The HBO docuseries Hard Knocks followed the Giants front office last spring. And the biggest headline for the show was what would happen with Barkley. Was he getting too old, too prone to injury? Would it be worth re-signing him?
I think just mulling over this, the right thing to do is let you test the market and see what your value is.
This is Giants general manager Joe Shane on the phone with Barkley, telling him good luck out there. Later, team owner John Mara worries about where Barkley might end up, the worst-case scenario being divisional rival, the Philadelphia Eagles.
I'm going to have a tough time sleeping if Saquon goes to Philadelphia, I'll tell you that.
Fast forward 10 months to Sunday night, and Barkley celebrating with his 2 young daughters and the Eagles-colored confetti after the game. Later, as his new teammates partied in the locker room, the soft-spoken Barkley said his success this year was what he had expected from himself all along.
You know, I've always known who I am. I always know the type of player I will become. Sometimes it takes longer than others, you know what I mean? I didn't envision it taking 7 years, or I didn't envision even being Philly. You know, I thought it would be able to accomplish that with New York, but no timing is better than God's timing, so it's got to take advantage of it.
He's allowing himself a couple days to take it all in. Then it'll be time to switch gears, he says. After all, he and the Eagles still have one more game this season, next month's Super Bowl against Kansas City. Becky Sullivan, NPR News, Philadelphia.
This is NPR News.
Ancient bronze statues taken from temple ruins in Thailand are heading home.
It was not too difficult to determine that they were looted.
A museum in San Francisco has now explained to the public how it got them in the first place. Is this openness a trend? That's tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The musician Nico Case writes that when she starts to sing, rage heats up in her chest.
Her new memoir explains why.
I don't think forgiveness as a blanket solution is at all healthy. There's absolutely room for people's rage.
First, the newscast.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. The acting U.S. Attorney General is moving to dismiss several prosecutors who investigated Donald Trump. NPR's Carrie Johnson reports on upheaval inside the Justice Department only days after Trump's inauguration.
More than a dozen Justice Department officials who worked alongside Special Counsel Jack Smith have received firing notices, according to two sources inside the building. Acting Attorney General James McHenry wrote they could not be trusted in, quote, faithfully implementing the president's agenda. The termination letters were first reported by Fox News. Trump campaigned on a promise of retribution, and his appointees to lead the DOJ and the FBI have talked about wanting to investigate the investigators. Jack Smith resigned before he could be fired, as did another senior national security lawyer, but many more career prosecutors and agents on his team remained on the job. Both cases against Trump were dropped after he won last year's election. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
Well, on Capitol Hill, the Senate has confirmed President Trump's choice to run the Treasury Department. Scott Bessent is a billionaire hedge fund manager from South Carolina who has spoken highly of Trump's use of tariffs on foreign goods as a negotiating tool. As Treasury Secretary, Bessent would have very big influence over economic, regulatory, and international affairs.
We must work to get our fiscal house in order and adjust federal domestic discretionary spending that has grown by an astonishing 40% over the past 4 years. Productive investment that grows the economy must be prioritized over wasteful spending that drives inflation.
Bessent becomes the first openly gay cabinet member in a Republican administration. This is NPR. The Golan Heights is an area of Syria that's long been mostly occupied by Israel, which has settled the mountainous region, but neighboring communities there say Israeli forces are taking control of more. Here's NPR's Emily Fang.
Syrian residents in the Golan Heights told NPR that Israeli tanks rolled into their villages days after rebels toppled a dictatorship run by the Assad family in Syria. The troops are restricting their movements in and out of the Syrian villages, both inside and outside a buffer zone monitored by the United Nations following a 1973 war with Israel and Egypt. This is Mohammed Al-Fayyad, who is from a town in the buffer zone. He says Syria was liberated from the Assads, but then the Israeli occupation came. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said the expansion is a, quote, temporary defensive position, but has not set a date to withdraw. Emily Fang, NPR News, the Golan Heights.
California lawmakers are considering legislation to allow wildfire victims here to sue oil and gas companies for damages. The proposal claims that the oil industry intentionally deceived the public about the risks of fossil fuels in terms of climate change that has intensified storms and wildfires, causing billions of dollars in damages in California alone. The bill is supported by environmental and consumer groups. Oil industry plans to fight it. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Susie Wiles is doing something no woman has done before. She is the first in history to hold the position of White House Chief of Staff. And now we will find out if she can do something that no one, no man nor woman has ever done before. And that is impose discipline and order on a Trump White House that was rife with leaks, drama, and by many accounts, chaos during his first term. For a look at Susie Wiles' chances, I'm joined now by journalist Chris Whipple. He's the author of several books, including The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. Welcome.
Great to be with you.
Great to have you. So I understand that at one point you had interviewed every living White House chief of staff. Is that still true?
Yeah, no, it is true. I interviewed all 17 living White House chiefs of staff
Wow.
for my book, The Gatekeepers. This was just before Trump came into office, and afterwards I interviewed Reince Priebus as well. So I can't say that I've interviewed every living chief to date, but I have interviewed the latest one, which is Susie Wiles.
Yeah, let's talk about Susie Wiles specifically and what you're noticing so far. I mean, before she even became President Trump's chief of staff, she was the co-chair of his presidential campaign, and I know that you follow Trump's campaign closely. You have a forthcoming book about it. What did you learn about Susie Wiles from her time in that role?
Well, she's an absolutely fascinating character. You know, she cut her teeth as a 23-year-old scheduler for Ronald Reagan, later worked in his Labor Department. But she really spent most of her political career, really all of her political career, in Florida. She was indispensable to Donald Trump's success in Florida. And he made her his 2024 co-chair, and she has this uncanny ability to impose some discipline on Trump's disorder. And that's going to be, of course, the ultimate test for her in the Trump White House.
Well, now that she is White House Chief of Staff, you know, what we've seen just during the first week of Trump 2.0 is something vastly different, right, from the first week of his first term. Like, the administration unveiled and implemented a blizzard of executive actions with tremendous speed and efficiency. Do you attribute that to Susie Wiles in particular or to a whole host of advisors?
I think it's too early to say to what extent this is Susie Wiles and how much of it is Trump. And, I would question the efficiency, as you put it. I mean, I think the so-called shock and awe has been certainly distracting, maybe effective in some cases, but it's no formula for long-term success in the Oval Office. You know, I'll never forget Erskine Bowles, Bill Clinton's third chief of staff, once told me that President Clinton used to have 1,000 great ideas every day, and I'd have to turn him around, walk him back into the Oval Office and say, Mr. President, you and I agreed that we were going to do 5 or 6 things. And if you stick to that, I can set up the focus and the structure to get that done. But you can't do 1,000 things.
Yeah.
That's something that Trump is going to find out or not. He really didn't learn much about governing in his first 4 years.
So what do you think Susie Wiles could do differently from her predecessors to make the relationship different than that relationship between previous chiefs of staff and President Trump?
So I think Susie Wiles brings a couple of advantages that her predecessors never had. I mean, I mentioned this uncanny ability she has to work with Trump. She seems to choose her fights carefully, maybe too carefully. I mean, most White House chiefs would have thrown their body in front of that decision to pardon 1,500 insurrectionists. Hmm. The other thing is that I think temperament is an underrated part of being White House Chief of Staff. And Susie Wiles has it. She has charm in abundance, and she's going to need every bit of it to be successful.
Well, I want to talk about a potential third person in this relationship. Elon Musk, because even before Trump was sworn in, we saw Elon Musk wading into a legislative fight over a government funding bill ahead of Trump. How do you see Wiles managing the Musk-Trump dynamic?
Very carefully, I would say. And we've already seen, to some extent, Susie Wiles giving a sharp elbow to Musk. I think that she's already made it clear that he's not going to have an office in the West Wing.
Right.
So round one to Susie Wiles, really. But it's going to be a fascinating dynamic to watch, because I'm told that early on during the transition, it was really Trump and Musk and maybe Don Jr. They were essentially spitballing cabinet nominees, and they were the ones who came up with Matt Gaetz, and Susie wasn't in the room. Well, to be an effective White House chief, she's going to have to be in the room for those decisions. In fact, an empowered White House chief really should be the last person in the room.
Chris Whipple. He is the author of The Gatekeepers and also of the forthcoming Uncharted, How Trump Beat Biden, Harris, and the Odds in the Wildest Campaign in History. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
A man who was a cornerstone of Atlanta rap has died. DJ Unk was 43 years old. NPR music reporter Sydney Madden has this remembrance.
If you were listening to the radio in the 2000s, there's a good chance you know this song.
Hey, now walk it out, now walk it out, now walk it out, now walk it out, DJ, now walk it out, now walk it out.
The man behind that track was Unk, the Atlanta rapper, producer, and DJ, responsible for helping launch Snap Music into the mainstream, died last week. In 2006, Unk commanded all of hip-hop with his breakthrough track, Walk It Out, an infectious hit that became a staple of Snap Music, the fun-loving hip-hop subgenre of the mid-2000s that put the party at the forefront. Snap Music was a reminder that hip-hop wasn't too cool to dance. Finger snapping and hi-hats emphasized the groove, and songs like Walk It Out came with instructions right in it. As a single, Walk It Out soared, peaking at number 10 on the Billboard Hot 100. Culturally, it was pushed even further, thanks to Outkast and Jim Jones hopping on the official remix. Unk kept the party going in 2007 with his follow-up single, featuring the same Snap Music energy, Two Step. Unk, whose real name was Anthony Platt, was a standout star of the Atlanta-based label Big Ump Records, thanks to these hits. He remained active in the Atlanta music and nightlife scene for years after. In 2009, he suffered a heart attack at the age of 27 that motivated him to change his lifestyle. He continued to drop music over the years, releasing his last official single in 2023. Unk's wife, Shakita Longplatt, confirmed news of his death on Friday with a Facebook post. Big Ump Records shared in a statement, "The imprint that he left globally will be cherished forever." Unk was 43 years old. Sydney Madden, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. Today's story comes from Claire Burnside Auk. When Burnside Auk was in college, she waited tables at a high-end restaurant. One night, she had a group of 12, and a man at the table ordered two expensive bottles of wine. Burnside Auk dreaded opening wine because she had a history of doing it wrong. When she began to open this man's bottle, she looked down, realized she had broken the cork. Half was stuck in her corkscrew, and the other half was stuck inside the bottle.
And I glance at the man who ordered the wine, and my eyes are just saucers. I'm terrified. And he just kind of leans over and places his hands on the bottle and looks at me and says, "I got it." And he took it from my hands and kind of turned his back so no one else could see and sort of leaned down and worked the cork. But at that point, the only thing you could do was to push the other half of the cork into the bottle. So now there's a half a cork floating in this beautiful bottle of wine. And I thought, there's no way he's going to drink this. What is going to happen? He's going to want it replaced. He's going to talk to my manager. It's going to come out of my check. And instead, he pours himself a glass that has little tiny flecks of cork in it and proceeds to drink it. And he said, "You're busy. We'll pour the rest." And the way he looked at me was so kind. And then he leaned over and he said, "Don't worry. It happens." And he turned to his guests and he started pouring them wine, and everything was fine. I think of this man often because I hear him in my own voice when my daughters break something by accident or a server spills something on my clothes. "It happens. I got it." It's amazing how disarming those words are and how they can completely redirect a situation from one ending to another. And if I could talk to that man again, I would say, "I heard you, and you're aces. Thank you."
Claire Burnside Ock lives in Nairobi, Kenya. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at myunsunghero.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Mathnasium, committed to making math fun and building confidence so students can achieve their potential this school year, offering customized math instruction and individual attention to students in grades K through 12. Mathnasium.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. As a child of the Pacific Northwest, I've always thought of the musician Nico Case as one of ours. Her solo records and her albums with the band The New Pornographers sound to me like they come from the gray skies and green hills of Washington State, where she grew up.
I'm so tired, I'm so tired, and I wish I was the moon tonight.
Nico Case's new memoir paints her upbringing as something out of a dark fairy tale, where adults are wicked and animals come to the rescue. Here she is reading from her book, The Harder I Fight, The More I Love You.
As a kid, it seemed so obvious that there was a violent force breathing hard behind us, dragging itself, wounded and angry, toward us faster than we could run. Eventually, my parents were destroyed by it, but nobody would tell me its name or where it had come from. No wonder I went looking in all these old folktales trying to find the answers. No wonder I wanted to turn myself into a creature who knew all the answers.
Nico Case was born to teenagers who weren't ready to be parents, and she begins her memoir with a shocking episode involving her mother. As she writes, a stunt so bizarre, I'm reluctant to even tell it, as it's completely unbelievable. Her father, sobbing, told young Nico, "Your mommy died." But that wasn't true.
She faked her death, and she went to live in Hawaii, and I thought she was dead. My father thought she was dead. My stepfather thought she was dead. And I even went to a wake that my grandmother had at her house for my mother. So I thought my mother had died for a year and a half, 2 years.
And when you were told that she actually wasn't dead and that she had come back?
I was just so excited she was back that I didn't really care what the reasoning was. I just was so depressed and so sad that I was like, okay, I don't have to be depressed and sad anymore. So I didn't question it. And also, you know, I was in third grade.
Sure. And it also seems like it had you walking on eggshells.
Yeah. She said she had come back for me, but she wasn't really around much. And so I kind of put two and two together after a while that, like, I kind of had to be an extra good kid to keep her around, which I didn't manage to do.
Because she was never going to stay around, no matter what kind of a kid you were.
Exactly. Like, she just didn't want kids, which is absolutely valid and acceptable. But to go to such lengths to not have a kid is really... you know, driving it home in a way that is really hard to come back from. When you try to find yourself on the map of where you are, you have to consider everything that's gone before you. I am a white settler, child of immigrants, and there's something about the way Indigenous people here in North America talk about their ancestors and their ancestors being present that I really wish I had. That I don't.
And yet the fact that your family never talked about themselves allows you to make some discoveries late in life that are really quite wonderful. Like your grandmother.
Yeah, old silent clam herself.
Old silent clam herself.
Yeah. She never talked about herself.
But you learned.
I learned that she was in a harmony singing band with her brother, and you know, I think I'd made like 3 records by then. And then one day she's like, oh, yes, I was in a band with Edwin. And I'm like, what? What are you talking about? Why wouldn't I want to have known that? I don't know. You know, she just was like, I don't know.
How did that shape your understanding of who you are and where you come from?
It shaped the part that says you'll never know where you come from because nobody's going to tell you. Unless you accidentally bring it up. Like, I didn't know I had an aunt who was a big time wrestler either.
Right.
Until I questioned my grandmother about it. I was like, do we have a relative? Oh, yes. Elsie. She was a wrestler. Very famous. And I was just like, what? Why wouldn't you tell me that either?
You didn't grow up dreaming of being a singer, songwriter, or a band leader. And in fact, when you did start making music, it was as the drummer. You say that making music could become a physical manifestation of the blazing wild horse energy inside my body.
Notes are hung so effortless with the rise and fall of Spell's breast.
Can you describe what that feels like?
Well, drumming is very different from singing, but you need your whole body to do both of the things. It's a continuous movement where you're constantly changing what your body is doing, but there's this constant clench that's happening. And it feels really good because it's also releasing something.
Right.
And I've never tried to describe drumming to people before. That one seems, think of the visual and think of how good that looks like it must feel. And it does.
It's perfect. It's perfect. It feels exactly how it looks. I've never drummed, but I totally understand what you mean by that.
It really feels fantastic.
You know, a lot of memoirs that excavate stories of trauma have some kind of larger moral or lesson. And there is a moment in this book when you say, bad things aren't always teaching you a lesson, which is a tough thing to absorb. And I wonder what the journey was that you took to get to that place.
Well, there's a lot of talk with trauma, especially when dealing with, you know, trauma that's held by women, where you are told that forgiving the situation or the person makes you a better person, that you're the better person if you do that. And it's not true at all. It's kind of used as a way to make us let go of the truth of that particular situation. Forgiveness itself is one of the most beautiful things in the world, but it is not something that you perform. It's its own, you know, organic state of being. You know, working through things and forgiving someone naturally because you want to, or because that's really how you feel, is great. But I don't think forgiveness as a blanket solution is at all healthy. There's absolutely room for people's rage. And I think that validating your own rage is much more important than trying to follow some prescribed path of forgiveness.
Well, Nico Case, it's really been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you for your candor and your openness.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Her memoir, The Harder I Fight, The More I Love You, is out tomorrow.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students by sharing what works in pre-K through 12 education at edutopia.org. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.